Welcome to Innovation Conversations with your host, David Karabinas. This podcast series is brought to you by PointClear, featuring conversations with technology innovators and entrepreneurs. Today we are talking with Dr. Neil Evans, PointClear's Chief Technology Officer. Neil has deep knowledge of enterprise-class architectures and over 15 years of his career devoted to crafting robust software and to designing creative solutions. Neil's passion is for identifying the best solution for difficult problems in the fast-changing IT arena. He is an evangelist for the concept that software should be developed to help those who will use it, not for the gratification of the people who build it. In short, Neil believes in software with soul. More about that in a minute. But first, welcome, Neil. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, David. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thank you. Well, what do you see as some of the current emerging technologies in the web world and software development in general?
Well, that's a broad question, and I guess it depends on who you're talking to. From our perspective at PointClear, I think you could say the current movement can be characterized by the concept that the user is king or the user is queen, whatever be the case. And this is manifested in several different ways. For us, there's this concept that we hear a lot about consumer empowerment in healthcare in particular. And this is the idea that the patient or the user of healthcare services should be given the tools they need so that they can manage their healthcare more themselves, get the information that they're interested in, rather than relying on their healthcare providers to just feed them what they think is best for them. In addition to this, there's the usability practice, which Lee Fairbaugh has talked about in a prior podcast. And also, I think our approach to working with our clients addresses this. It's an approach we like to think produces something that truly satisfies their needs, and that's something that I call software with soul.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. We hear a lot about concepts like Web 2.0 and social networking. What are these all about?
Well, in general, those are buzzwords. Typical of buzzwords, you hear them thrown around a lot, and sometimes they're not particularly meaningful. In some ways, Web 2.0 is maybe even something that's kind of passe now. It really, from what I can tell, looking into this, sort of preparing for this interview, it seems like it really hit the hype scale in 2004. But be that as it may, you hear about it a lot. Time Magazine's Person of the Year was you last year, which was a reference to all this stuff.
Right, right.
Web 2.0 wraps together several different concepts, but I think the most fundamental of which is the idea that technology on the web and really, not necessarily server technology, because that's not like there's been a huge leap in advancement there recently, but high-speed internet's penetrated enough households and that sort of thing. It's gotten to the point where you can really start talking about hosting applications on the web in the user's browser instead of running it on the user's PC. And so in a sense, this is the revenge of the mainframe. So if you think about it in the old paradigm, way back when, people would just get on terminals with a green flashing cursor, and they would access the mainframe to do the things they needed. And then there was the whole PC revolution. And now it's almost like we come back full circle.
Hmm.
An illustration of this that I think has gotten sort of popularized in the media is the whole Google versus Microsoft battle. And Microsoft, I guess, I'm not sure of this, but I think their most profitable product is Microsoft Office. And everyone's familiar with Office for the most part.
Right.
Sort of the quintessential PC application. Well, I mean, Google is not even afraid to take that on, and they have their own version of Office called Google Office, and the key difference being that it runs entirely within a user's web browser. There's nothing to install. So that's a revolutionary change there, I think.
So another way to look at Web 2.0, well, what you're teaching me here is that it's really not a set of products per se, but it's more of a concept that you're you're moving the computing power off the desktop or the laptop and onto these servers that are providing the applications from corporations.
Absolutely. So a particular example, again, Google Office runs on Google servers. A user doesn't go to Best Buy and get a shrink wrap product off the shelf and then come home and install it on their PC. They just point their browser, whatever that may be, to the Google servers, and the application is immediately there. There's no upgrading. There are different models, obviously. Some people can charge for these services. Google, somehow their model works where these things are completely free at the moment. I don't think everyone's like that. But the key thing is they have all the servers to support all the users that are going to run their application.
Does Web 2.0 also mean a shift in the use of the Internet? You know, originally it was access to information, but there weren't any really powerful applications that people use via the net. But now you're describing to me that, you know, this is where it seems to be going.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. And that sort of gets into the second part of your question about social networking. But
yep.
Initially, I guess, the web was seen as another generic media outlet, like a newspaper or a magazine or television, where everything was, from the user's perspective, was passive. You would just go to a particular place, you know, like a CNN or what have you, and the news just comes to you, and you just read it. There's not a whole lot of interaction there. And I think another aspect of Web 2.0 is this whole movement to give the user more power and more tools to customize the experience to suit their individual tastes and needs. Talking about social networking in particular, I think of things like blogs and wikis, and then I think of sites like Facebook and YouTube and MySpace. And here, all these places are, I mean, what's being leveraged here is that, these are extreme examples where the people who host the sites don't even produce the content. The content is all user-generated. So if you go to YouTube, all the videos, in general, I think as a general rule, YouTube doesn't actually post videos to their own site. They just gave all the tools, and all the videos on YouTube come from the users who participate in it. And so it's sort of the ultimate in if you build it, they will come.
Interesting.
That's definitely an aspect of Web 2.0 as well.
So this leads me to believe that the role of the user with these new concepts or these new applications via Web 2.0 or where this is going is pretty strategic and pretty critical. How are companies changing their strategies for designing software to account for this apparent rise in the supremacy of the user, if you will?
Yeah, that's a very good question. One thing... And I guess I sort of touched on this already, but you have to give users the tools they need so that they are interested in creating their own content. So it can be as simple as, giving them the tools that they can, for example, write blogs. And a blog is essentially it's an easy way for people to post information to a website so that other people can see it. I mean, you don't need to be an application developer or know all the intricacies of HTML and CSS and all that sort of thing to write a blog. A wiki's kind of in the same vein there. Or, for example, uploading pictures to Flickr or creating vanity sites like on MySpace and Facebook, I think are good examples of that as well. So the idea is for a business is to create software tools that give the users everything they need to do that sort of thing. You just have to create a platform for them. And you don't, in the old days, another buzzword you used to hear not too long ago was content is king. And I guess that's still true, but, in the old days, maybe like if you were someone at AOL, you really would be concerned with we need to get as much content onto the AOL side as possible to keep people coming here, to make people want to come and become AOL users. And, now it's not necessarily something that's put on the shoulders of the companies. It's just, with this whole social networking movement and all that sort of thing, then it's just a matter of giving the users what they need to do that themselves.
You describe Software with Soul as kind of the central point of it is that software needs to be usable. It needs to be designed and developed with usability and the end user in mind. So in everything that you've described so far is leading me to believe that the use of software via the internet is very much an issue out there in the industry. In the podcast with Lee Fairbaugh, she described how things have changed over the years and they're getting better. And she's developed this usability practice within PointClear. Does this supremacy of the user, is that the reason that PointClear has developed this practice and where you see that going?
Yeah, that's definitely a major part of it. I think the usability thing to me was new, mainly because of my own ignorance. But once I've learned about it from talking with Lee, I think it's very exciting, and I also think it's extremely important to keep in mind when you're developing these new applications. And there's several reasons for that. First of all, I think users are no longer going to be patient enough to tolerate sites that don't have good usability. And the reason is there's a lot of great examples of highly usable sites out there. So it's like the watermark is that level is rising in terms of there's just very good quality sites out there. And
right.
If you develop a site that is shoddy or is not fun to use or is still inefficient or illogical, their users are not going to tolerate that and they're not going to come back.
So it's become a competitive differentiator for companies.
Yeah, most definitely. That's a really good way to put it. And the second thing is, if you talk about rolling out a complex application to a web platform, like a Google spreadsheet, for example, or some other complex business application, then you have to take special care because the you're going to have to get as close as you can to the experience the user is accustomed to on the desktop. So, I mean, you can't. Let me give you a good example. If you were to roll out a spreadsheet sort of application to the web using the old paradigm where the whole page refreshes. I mean, can you imagine editing a cell and then having to wait for the page to go back to the server and come back with the whole spreadsheet refreshed? It would just be, it wouldn't work. I mean, that's the reason it's been hard to move these complex applications to the web in the first place. So it's a differentiator for businesses, definitely. I can give some other examples of that, but also when you start talking about rolling out complex applications, you have to take usability, it's just an absolute necessity, you have to take usability into account.
Can you tell us more about some specific technologies that are out there today, like this thing called AJAX? What is AJAX, and how significant is it in the overall story of the development of the web?
Well, AJAX is another buzzword right now, and it also falls under the umbrella of Web 2.0, I would say. It's maybe more of a geeky term. What it stands for, putting on my geek hat, is asynchronous JavaScript and XML. But before, rather than going too deep into the actual nuts and bolts of the technology, it's probably easier to describe it this way, sort of a before and after. Traditionally, the way web pages used to work, you would go to a web address or you would click a link. And the browser would then make a request to the server. The server would process that request and send back a page. And then your browser would receive that page and paint it so that you could read it. And then you would go and you would fill out a form or do something or another, and you click submit. And then basically the whole process would start over again. So it's submit, refresh, et cetera. And the key thing is that the whole page refreshes every time. Now, this may not seem like that big of a deal, but if you're old enough to think back to the early 90s or the mid-90s when most people were surfing on a dial-up connection, refreshing a large page can take a few seconds. I mean, this is a key user experience issue. Now, the way what Ajax changes is, instead of reloading the entire page with every call, the an Ajax web application exchanges small amounts of information behind the scenes. So the browser and the server still interact, but the user is not necessarily aware of that. And then it just updates the part of the web page that needs to be updated. So it doesn't update the whole page. It's much more focused in terms of what gets changed. And in this way, it's much closer to a traditional client-server desktop model that we're familiar with. And also, desktops have rich user interfaces. So basically, Ajax is a tool that allows web application developers to bring a rich UI that you would normally have on the desktop in the web world. This is significant for a number of reasons. It's definitely significant from the user's perspective. But for guys like me who actually write web applications, it's a totally new paradigm shift. And I could talk more about that, but you know, generally, if you've written web applications and you're a software developer, then you've always been concerned about what we call server-side technologies. You do stuff on the server, and that's where your coding happens. And the browser is just that thing you just kind of you shove the end results to, and the browser just shows it, and that's it. But now everything moves back over to the client, and the server is just basically the database, and then you just build some lines or services that allow the client to interact with your database. But all the a ton of the business logic and all that sort of stuff gets shoved over to the client. That's something completely new.
So Ajax, it sounds like, provides operational efficiency, if you will, in the experience. But does it also improve the usability of the applications?
I think one of the main motivators behind doing Ajax is the usability. I mean, there are some other benefits to it, like it does make things more efficient because you're not having to push so much traffic across the wire every time. But the web page is all if you when you come from a desktop world and you're accustomed to building those sorts of applications, and then you move over to the web world, at least in the old paradigm, it could be very frustrating because it's a completely different. It's very primitive. You have primitive sorts of widgets that you can use in general, and by widgets I mean like drop downs and radio buttons and that sort of thing. And then you know, basically the whole page refreshes every time. That's kind of strange. And you just don't have a lot of control over, in the old paradigm, what the user sees, controlling that whole experience. You just can't do rich stuff. And there have been a lot of ways that's been addressed over the years, other than Ajax even. I mean, there are other technologies like Flash as a product that allows you to build richer UIs, and that's been around longer than Ajax. But With Ajax, you can start basically. I mean, there's a limit, but for the most part, anything you can do on the desktop, you can, in terms of user experience, you can come close to doing that in the web as well.
Well, it sounds like PointClear is on the leading edge, if you will, of these technologies and concepts. How has PointClear leveraged, say, Ajax and Web 2.0 to help its clients? And specifically, what things have worked well in what things have not worked so well?
That's a very good question. And I mean, now you're getting more into sort of war stories, and I can tell a few. We have been developing a Web 2.0 Ajax application for one of our clients, and some of the things that we've learned probably are too technical for this conversation, but there's still some interesting things I can One thing is Ajax is a relatively new technology. It's not so bleeding edge that it hasn't been adopted. Otherwise, we're more interested in what we do and not necessarily living on the bleeding edge, but using those things which are actually useful for helping out our customers.
Sure.
We don't want to necessarily push them out on a limb. And so it's new, but it's not so cutting edge that it's. I mean, there are many popular sites where it's been implemented. Yahoo Mail, the Google Office applications I already mentioned, Gmail, even Microsoft has this Microsoft Live stuff, which uses a lot of Ajax. But my point in saying all this is that since it is sort of on the front line, not everything is completely solidified. I mean, not everything is gelled. So, like, in a practical sense, the different libraries and components that you use to build an Ajax application are still in flux a little bit. So there are new versions coming out all the time, bug fixes, et cetera. Not everything's standardized. Microsoft has their own version, their own take on Ajax, which is a little bit different than everyone else, which is not an atypical thing for Microsoft to do. You can't necessarily use a lot of tools you're used to. Like, for example, Microsoft, if you're a Microsoft web application developer, you might have been accustomed to using Visual Studio and ASP.NET, and a lot of things you learn there are just not applicable to building an Ajax application. So there's a learning curve there, and what that means is there's not necessarily a lot of talent who has a lot of direct experience building Ajax applications. So we're very fortunate at Point Clear that we've been able to do this and start, you know, we're building up a portfolio of experience that we can bring to bear on future problems as well. Ajax is an entire, like I mentioned before, it's an entirely client-side technology. And that means that it's written in JavaScript. And again, I don't want to get too technical, but if you are a software developer, JavaScript immediately, if someone mentions that, gives you a bad taste. It has a bad name, redheaded stepchild of programming languages, and it's just not generally considered to be a serious language. And so a lot of people are you know, sort of recoil from that as soon as they hear that, you know, if you're going to write an Ajax application, you're going to be doing a lot of JavaScript. I think that's unfounded for a number of reasons, but not to go into that here. There are other things we've run into as well. For example, you know, as part of our usability efforts, you know, we pay close attention, Lee in particular, to making sure that our websites are accessible, for example. And a lot of people who, there are a lot of folks out there who use, for example, screen readers to allow them to interact with websites by, you know, actually having the page read to them. And Ajax web applications, because of the way they work, generally don't play well with screen readers. So we've had to do certain things to make sure that we can get our applications to work with screen readers. I'm not actually entirely sure that problem has been completely solved, but there are people dealing with that. There's another general problem, which really this is true of all web applications, but it just gets amplified with Ajax applications. Browser compatibility. So, you know, there are multiple browsers. Internet Explorer is the most common, but it's, you know, it may be, I think its market share is whittled down to, actually, I'm not even sure. It might even be down below 80 now. But there are people who use Firefox, Safari, Opera, et cetera. And none of these browsers interpret standards in the same way. So when you test your Ajax web application, you have to test it on all these multiple platforms. And it can become very complicated, very frustrating when you find something that works in one way in one browser and in another way in another browser. You basically have to hack things. End up doing a whole bunch of big if clauses, if Safari, if IE, et cetera, and that's kind of a smelly way to code, we like to say.
Well, Dr. Evans, you have a PhD in physics and a background in science. How did you get interested in software?
Really, I've been interested in software even before I got interested in science. I mean, I guess I could say, in all honesty, I've always been a nerd. I really got started programming in high school back in the 80s. A good friend of mine that I grew up with, we used to get together over the summer, and we built a BBS, a bulletin board service. And this was the days before the internet was ubiquitous, and, you know, I mean, the internet existed, but not everyone had access to it. So this was why, if you ever seen that movie War Games, that was kind of the ultimate BBS movie. Everybody, you know, had a modem and, like, even, like, have a phone coupler and that sort of stuff, and they would dial up to servers, and that was the way everyone interacted. We actually built a BBS, and it was called Martyrdom, but it ran. What was cool about it was that it ran the software was called WWIV or WW4. And what was neat about WWIV is that you could actually download the source code. So this was kind of the days before open source and all that stuff. I guess this is like the original open source. And it was written in C. And I guess being, a nerd, I completely got hooked that you could modify the code for it and rebuild it and, you know, cause it to do the things that you want it to. And so I can remember, you know, we had a Borland compiler. It would take like 5 hours to compile all the source and executable. I don't know. No one will think that's funny unless you're true.
Well, let me ask you a question. How does your background in science translate to the day-to-day world of solving problems in software? And are there lessons you have learned in physics that can be applied to help, you know, people be more innovative and creative relative to software?
Sure. I think to answer that, I have a little quote I'd like to read from one of my heroes, the great physicist Richard Feynman. And he says, and he has a great book, which I highly recommend to everyone, called The Pleasure of Finding Things Out. It's just it's meant for a general audience. It's not a scientific treatise or anything like that. But he says, the scientist has a lot of experience with ignorance and doubt and uncertainty. And this experience is of very great importance, I think. When a scientist doesn't know the answer to the problem, he is ignorant. When he has a hunch about what the result is, he is uncertain. And when he is pretty darn sure of what the result is going to be, he still is in some doubt. We have found it of paramount importance that in order to progress, we must recognize this ignorance and leave room for doubt. Scientific knowledge is a body of statements of varying degrees of certainty, some most unsure, some nearly sure, but none are absolutely certain. And so what I take from this is, or what I've learned from my training in physics is in general, how to deal with uncertainty. And I think uncertainty is a fact of life, and in terms of, you know, applying this to software, software is an engineering practice, and engineering and science are closely related. They're not exactly the same. I guess they each emphasize different aspects. But in my mind, generally what, as an engineering practice, what you do in software is you have a certain set of methodologies, or I guess you could call them best practices, about, okay, if you encounter problem C, then do X, Y, and Z, and then you're going to arrive at some solution. Well, of course, in the real world, it never works so nicely, because you always, every problem, every client has a unique set of circumstances, and every problem has its own nuances. So what happens is the methodology breaks down somehow, and it doesn't lead you to the result that you would have expected otherwise. And that really, in general, characterizes not just physics, but science. You know, science in general, you're really kind of out in, if you're doing pure science, you know, basic research in particular, you're very often in uncharted territory. So it gives you a framework for dealing with uncertainty and how to manage that. And I think that applies nicely in software.
Well, that's interesting. Can you share with our listeners why PointClear is interested in software problems in the healthcare and life sciences space? And if you would, Neil, tell us about your background and the background of the other PointClear leaders as it relates to these industries.
Sure. I think we have two main value propositions at PointClear in terms of our consultancy practice. One of those focuses on usability, and that's what leads to doing issues. They're doing a wonderful job with that. The other thing is that we focus on solving software problems for companies in healthcare and life sciences. And there's business reasons for this, but I think one of the main motivations is just the practical one. We have, our people have a lot of experience working with these sorts of companies. And, you know, Lee, for example, has worked with the CDC in Atlanta, and she's also worked with Open Biosystems. Brian Pollack, you know, was also a prior podcast. Donnie Gooch has worked with all sorts of healthcare IT systems and has worked on integrating these guys. That's actually one of the biggest problems in healthcare, is there's so many different vendors of information technology systems, and there's not really a good set of well-established standards, but just having someone that's this work with a whole bunch of different vendors and knows how to make them all talk to each other. That's of an enormous value there. In my past, I worked with Imagion, which is another a clinical software company. And, you know, we're still engaged with clients that are in this space, both as providers or payers or, you know, even developing products that target the healthcare consumer and patients themselves.
Well, clearly those industries are spending a lot of money in IT these days, and there are a lot of problems to solve. So there seems to be a lot of opportunity there. There's something called that PointClear has developed, incubating this concept called Health Informatica. What is it, and what is the primary problem it's trying to solve?
Health Informatica is a lot of fun, and I think we're all really excited about this. The initial idea was Blaine Anderson's, and it's evolved over time. I think it's probably a good case study in how new products get developed and how entrepreneurs, you know, chase those things down and actually bring them to fruition, to something that's real, that's in the marketplace. Health Informatica, this actually, I'm reminded of the interview with Gary York, the first podcast, and he said when he, as I recall, when he was actually coming up with the, or attempting to come up with the idea for Awarex, that one of the things he did was he just went out and surveyed his contacts in the industry, CIOs at hospitals, et cetera, and asked them, what's a problem out there that you all face from day to day that could be solved with information technology? And just started the conversation that way. That's how we came up with the idea for Awarex. So we, in working with our clients and also talking with other people that our clients interact with, we have seen this problem over and over, and it can be summarized as follows. There are people out there that have different sorts of content. For example,
healthcare-related content. Right?
Healthcare-related content, yes.
Okay.
For example, you might have something that describes, just like an encyclopedia of different conditions and drugs, et cetera. And it's all nicely organized, and it has a beautiful presentation in terms of, you know, lots of pretty pictures and that sort of thing. And they want to get it delivered to the people who want to see that thing. Now, the traditional model is like a search engine model. The people who want that information will go search for it, and they'll find it that way. And that's fine. But this is this sort of flips things. In this case, we have people who want to deliver the content to particular demographics. And if there were just a way that those demographics could be defined, then it would be easy to say, you know, certain content, for example, you know, information about diabetes needs to go to people who are type 2 diabetics. And we see this a lot, both from those people who have that content, but also we happen to be working on products where we have information about individual users' demographics. And so basically Health Informatica is a broker that sits in between those two, you know, the content provider and the users who would be interested in that content and who the content providers want to give information to, and it sort of brings those two together.
That's
the basic problem that involves.
Okay, so but the content could be text, documents, video, audio, all of the above?
Exactly, and that's where it gets really interesting is when you start drilling down into it and seeing what all that implies. One of the big problems we'll have to solve here to make this compelling is the presentation to the user. And so, yeah, the content in a very generic sense could be at the most basic level, it could just be a set of links, almost like an RSS feed or something like that. But at a more interesting level, it could be video presentations or you know, some sort of rich flash presentation that's interactive and clickable. And so one of the problems that we're going to have to solve with Health Informatica is we're going to have to build a component, if you will, that can handle this whole spectrum of potential content that can be delivered. And we will leverage our usability experience to create an interface that does this in a compelling way.
My final question to all of our podcast interviewees is about lessons learned and war stories, and our listeners are always interested in those. Regarding software, software development and the internet, what lessons learned or what parting wisdom would you share with our listeners today?
That's a very good question. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the whole software with soul concept. And there's a there's a very good anecdote. Blaine actually is fond of talking about this. I can't remember if he mentioned this in his podcast or not, but it comes from one of these guys that we follow closely. He has a blog called Joel on Software, and there's one particular blog where he's talking about the difference between the sort of food you get from McDonald's versus the unique creations of the Naked Chef. If anybody, you know, watches Food Network and is familiar with the Naked Chef, and I've sort of reinterpreted this little anecdote in my own words. The idea is that, you know, if you go to a place like Applebee's or the Olive Garden, you're going to have certain expectations. I mean, if you enjoy that sort of thing, you're going to get a certain level of food, and it's almost always going to be the same way every time. And the reason we can do that is they've defined a process or a methodology that's easy for their employees to learn and produces predictable results over and over. But then you want to contrast that with, like, if you're from Birmingham, for example, you'd be familiar with, your top three restaurants might be Highlands or Bottega or Bright Star. And if you go to one of those places, you're going to get a very unique experience. You're going to get cuisine that is inspired, that's regionally inspired, that's unique to Birmingham. You're going to eat creations that are unique, you know, that are something that, and so the experience, I think you can see that you'd end up coming away with would be completely different at a Highlands or a Bottega versus going to an Applebee's or an Olive Garden. And so this works in software and as well. A lot of the approach to the way that you deal with software problems is to focus so much on methodologies and processes that what you end up with is a sterile, one-size-fits-all sort of result. You know, you get software this is the equivalent of food that you get at Olive Garden. I hope I don't insult anybody that really loves Olive Garden. But software with soul, what the idea there is that we want to work with our clients, and I mean, it sounds kind of trite, but we go in with the understanding that their problems are going to be unique and specific to them, and so we want to partner with them and serve them to understand those problems and produce solutions to them. And this goes back to the whole thing about uncertainty. We're not just going to apply methodologies or whatever. I mean, you know, certainly we're going to keep best practices in mind, but we also realize that there are limits to that. And the end result is where that people love to use, and that is software with soul.
Well, this has been very interesting, Neil. Really want to say thanks again for sharing your time and being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
And thanks to our listeners as well. You have been listening to Innovation Conversations with David Karabinas, a Clearcast series sponsored by PointClear.